Welcome to Wild West Filmmaking. I'm Josh David Jordan, and we are here today with none other than Tim DeLauder. Tim is a musician, a composer, and looking at my IMDb Pro, he's also an actor. And Tim is from Texas. Tim, where are we finding you today?
You're finding me in a place that used to house the rehearsal and all the storage and junk for the Polyphonic Spree. It's now my home. I'm on Ross Avenue.
You know, it's wild that that's where I was doing dailies of This World Won't Break. That was our This World Won't Break home base, with old Chris Burke lived there for a bit.
Yeah.
That was wild time. Well, dude, thanks for hopping on here. I know it's been wild. Are you settled back in from the Tripping Daisy tour?
Yeah, you know, that was a trip. It took a little bit, you know, I walked in my front door. My mother-in-law lived next door. She doesn't now, but she did. But I walk in the front door from the tour to, help me, help me. And I go in the backyard and Sandy's laying on the ground on the concrete. And I'm like, I'm in hospital mode, calling the ambulance. She'd been out there for 3 hours laying in the hot sun. She broke her femur.
Just recently?
Yeah. Like, right when I got back from tour, I'm walking the front door from the
airport,
and that's what I'm hit with. So it's been kind of chaotic here for a while. But
Oh my gosh.
She's now in physical therapy and she's about to move into a new place and she's doing good. So it's taken me a bit to kind of wind down from that tour. It was awesome. It went really well.
Awesome. And when you found her, there was like bifocals and sunglasses all around her, probably, that had fallen off her head.
Yeah, her mask was still on. She's been wearing a COVID mask since COVID. But she was just laying there. It was not a good sight. But she's doing good.
I feel like that's the story of your life. I do feel like, and same with mine a little bit, I feel like chaos and entertainment and all these crazy things follow us. And sometimes people get freaked out by the chaos. And I know that you know, you've always been an example of embracing chaos.
Please.
But I feel like you turn it, it's how you, and tell me this, it's kind of a way of how you, when people hear your music, when people see your creations and stuff, they're like, oh my gosh, it's like out of this world. It's because, like, I think that you really embrace and, you know, with head on life, right? And so you feel it, it's crazy. And then you're able to turn that into art in a way, right? That's how I feel. My crazy childhood, I've been able to like take that weirdness. Like my brother, it really messed him up. My older brother, the way we lived as traveling evangelist, he was never right with it. And for me, I just took it and it was like this weird, wild world that I could take and turn into something. So, I mean, I feel like you're the same way, right?
You know, gosh, embracing chaos, you know, I guess I never thought of it like that. I guess because it's just, you're right. It's just kind of, we're in it constantly. It seems like it gravitates to us, you know, for some weird reason. And we have no other choice but just to make it part of our life, which is really dysfunctional, but in a weird way. But it is what it is. And you're right. It makes you a little bit more an able body to handle things coming at you in all angles at any time. And that's kind of like what you have to do in order to get any kind of project going. Everything's coming at you. Got to be able to like sustain and weather the storms and roll with things that, you know, I didn't see this coming, you know, and it's just the way that it is. But yeah, I feel that everything that we go through as kids and growing up and all this information and all these incidents that come at us are just like, they're grooming us for how we're going to be able to handle our world that we're, you know, going to grow. And so, yeah, I think it does help. You don't have to like that process of life, you know, where you are in chaos all the time. It's a bit exhausting. And I don't want to say it's all the time. It just seems like it never stops. But when the times that it does, that just calm in the storm, it sure is nice, man. And I think those moments happen when you create something that you get to celebrate, and you kind of like can relax in that moment, you know? And I find, and those are the parts that kind of make you feel whole and yes, and I'm living, I'm doing it. And so then that's, I guess that's the reward, you know, that comes along with it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, let's go back. I didn't really have a, you know, I have like some notes. I always have notes up, but sometimes it's just like notes are notes. But like, let's go back to, since this is about, you know, cinema, movies, filmmaking. I know that, you know, we've been movie buddies for a long time, and it's really like just a part of our, you know, we're cut from the same cloth, but it's a part of our world. It's just, I don't know, sometimes when I can't figure things out, I'll see a movie and it gives me the answer, you know. So for you know, I grew up sort of being babysat by the television, you know. I didn't, it was TV, movies were on, there was cable TV and stuff like that. But then movies, I was trying to think the other day, the first movie that I ever saw, like in the theater, and then like what was the movie that like it felt magical? Like what was the first movie you remember watching? That's a tough question, but
The first movie I saw in the theater, I believe, was the Aristocats, Walt Disney Aristocats, and that was at the Wynwood Theater in Oak Cliff. My mom always took me to movies. Robin Hood, Disney movies, I kind of grew up on those when we would go see movies, and that was at a young age. That was, you know, I'm 5 years old seeing the Aristocats probably at that time. So my mom would take me to movies. She liked movies, and so that's kind of where it started for me. But I think, yeah, Aristocats was the first one, which, you know, that plays into my love from that point, you know, and I've talked about this before, that it gravitated to, you know, when you're sick, you know, you stay home from school, and you know, there wasn't movies on, so you had storybook records. Walt Disney had storybook records. That's where I kind of got into the storybook records and the symphonic world of telling stories with symphonic instruments, which I think played a huge part in the polyphonic spree. Film, movies, all that had a huge impact on me as a kid, and I think that's why. I know that's why I love them today, and I agree with you. There's nothing like going to see a movie and just having that time to like take off and escape. And maybe that's our little break from the chaos, is going to see a movie and live in someone else's story for a little bit.
for sure, it's always been like an escape for me. To this day, it still is to go, and I find it like right now, just with the madness that's going on with the new film and all, I'm really drawn to like sort of blockbuster or something that I can just go watch and escape, and nothing heavy where I'm trying to think, or even nothing too artistic, so I'm not watching what they were doing and then like self-doubting what I did. There's just a lot of things where, you know, I'm so sensitive to things like that where I just need to like completely escape. What's your I think I know the answer to this. What's your go-to movie snack? And has it always been the same, or has it evolved?
So it's has it evolved? Not really. Well, kind of. So it was always popcorn and Junior Mints, because that's what I had the first time I went with my mom, and she still gets them, and I still get them. When we go to the movies, we get it. So Junior Mints and popcorn, but now it's moved to popcorn and peanut M&Ms, and then I'll get a water. I don't drink sodas anymore, but now I've started cheating, so I'll get a water cup and sneak over and get a little bit of Slurpee in there. So I have a little bit of Slurpee, and then popcorn, peanut M&Ms, and a water, and that's my deal.
But you dump the Junior Mints in the popcorn though.
Yeah.
Yeah, people need
Yeah.
to know that. That's
Yeah.
something I wasn't prepared for when I reached over and got some.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a huge fan of chocolate and mint for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, and I'm not really either. That's I don't like mint chocolate ice cream. It's not my jam. But Junior Mints, I've liked them since I'm a kid. I was a kid. It was my mom that turned me on to it as a kid.
Nostalgic.
I've always associated Junior Mints and popcorn with the movies.
Okay, what's your, since we're talking about comfort things, before we dive into anything else of like, what's your comfort film? Is there, and you can name a one or two, something that you just put on, maybe you're watching it, maybe it's in the background, maybe you're laying on the couch. What's something you can always just put on? What's your...
There's a couple, Josh. There's a few things that I've watched over and over. The Old Man and the Sea, Spencer Tracy. Yeah. I don't know about that movie. Just fucking, I love that film. It's something that I kind of discovered a while back, and it was in, I was on tour with the Spree, and I just kind of put that movie just to kind of level me out. And I found that I would go to that periodically just to kind of like level out. It was like, it's like easy listening music watching that movie.
Yeah.
Now something, you know, away from that, you know, The Martian, I love that movie, Matt Damon, Martian. There's something about the solitude and him trying to figure things out, being by himself. It doesn't make me anxious. It just kind of, it goes with the tempo of myself, of like trying to figure things out and work problems. And there's something comforting to that, watch being a part of that. It's kind of solitude, and I like that. But
those are both films about solitude.
Yeah, they're I find that I'm kind of I don't mind being alone. I kind of thrive being alone a lot, and so that's kind of my jam, you know.
So I feel like there's something you always put on, something from the 80s. Is it not What About Bob? There's something I feel like you always are always watching.
Well, yeah, What About Bob was another one that like was on the comedy circuit, you know. What About Bob? I can still watch What About Bob. What did I just recently watch that I've watched several times? Groundhog Day, you know. Yeah. There was something I watched recently I wanted to talk to you about. I can't think of it right now.
Was it Tootsie?
Tootsie's another one, a favorite of mine. I've probably watched that film more than any other. I can't believe I didn't mention that one. I love that film too. But it wasn't that one. It was something else. But, you know, I've watched a couple of recent ones that I haven't talked to you about that I really like, but we may get to that later.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like I was, how famous Mrs. Doubtfire is and how much it's like, not a complete ripoff of Tootsie, but my gosh, there's so much. It's the same movie.
Yeah.
It's like the same point of this guy trying to win this woman over, dressing up like a woman.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre that people, I mean, maybe they did, maybe they compared that, but I don't remember people comparing it to Tootsie, but it's wild. So let's go back to, how did you get to where, and I know you've told the story a gazillion times, so you can do a short version of this. But I'm always like super intrigued of, because movies were a huge part of your life. So is music. And I feel like there was a moment when maybe acting, movies, you know, that was your dream. But then, I mean, you've made a living off of being a musician. That's so difficult. But you've also still had the opportunity and chance to live that dream still of cinema. So how did that start, and what was like the push, or like let's go? What was that let's go moment for you?
When I was in high school, I failed drama. I was in drama. I basically had to get out of there because I had a 50. Me and the teacher, Mrs. Bunch, didn't get along very well. So I had to get out of there. But I kind of always wanted to be an actor when I was younger, but I didn't really like, but I was also doing music in high school too, in junior high. I had bands. So it's like always entertainment, you know. And then out of high school, I moved to Los Angeles, 18, and went out there to be an actor. I had been doing music, but it's like, I'm gonna be an actress, so move out there. And I think I did one audition, but it turned out to be just trying to survive out there. It was so expensive. I didn't have any, we had a job as busser at TGI Fridays, but it ended up, I spent all my time just trying to live, pay my bills and stuff. And I wasn't that aggressive with it. I think that was after I did, no, I can't, either I came back into KD Studios, or I don't know if that was before KD Studios. Might have been after. No, yeah, after. And it didn't, I didn't take it serious, you know? And the music, when I came back from Dallas, I moved to Colorado, and I just kind of floated around after high school. And I was living out there managing a warming hut in Crested Butte, Colorado. And I did an open mic, and that's when I realized I need to be doing music. It just kind of hit me. Came back, and that's when I started Tripping Daisy. And then I just kind of put the acting thing to the side. Like, this is what I'm going to do. And I went full bore into music. I knew exactly what I wanted. I had a vision. I had the vision, and I was working towards it, where you don't see anything else but what you're doing. And once that happens, it's pretty much over. That's what you're going to get, and that's what you're going to do. So that's just where it was until you and I started. Like, you know, I had a couple auditions here in town, and I blew those up because I even got hired for it, and I blew it up on set. The director had to ask me to leave because I gave away a Christmas tree to this family. I got was had been drinking, and it was I lost it. It was a would have been a big deal, but we were shooting the day, and I had been drinking, and there was a Christmas tree lot across the street, and there was this little kid and the mom, and the kid wanted this tree, and she couldn't afford it, and I acted like I worked at the Christmas tree lot, and basically was giving them the Christmas tree and taking it to their car, and the guy came out there and just, you know, just went off on me. The people across the street where we were filming the commercial saw it. He went over there, made a big hubbub about it, and they fired me from the commercial. That was, yeah, that was my last acting thing was that. And I was doing the band at that time, and yeah,
You were doing
weird.
Tripping Daisy at the time?
I was starting Tripping Daisy at the time. Yeah, it was like right at the beginning of that. Is when that happened. So that was my last stint with acting until you and I started messing around.
Wow. But Tripping Daisy, did you guys, were y'all, you never composed anything with Tripping Daisy, but that was back in the day when soundtracks and scores and TV shows were more compilations. So you guys were hopped on compilations, and then you did the Sea Monster. I just had a
Yeah,
fart.
Sigmund in the Sea
Yeah,
Monster.
you guys reimagined that. Was
Yeah.
that your was that the first? I mean, that was your favorite show growing up, right? Was that just like was that something you pursued, or was that something that just happened? It was the magic of the universe that happened.
So that was well, that's also, I mean, that's just, you know, Tripping Daisy had some popularity. There's things going on. There's a guy that's putting a Saturday morning cartoon compilation together. And just grabbing bands that are of that time that have a draw, you know, who are mean something. And they asked Tripping Daisy, and I ended up becoming good friends with this guy, Ralph Saul, who was the producer of that particular pro of that whole thing. Saturday Morning Car. They actually made a show with Drew Barrymore. She was in it. I was a Sid and Marty Krofft fan, and he and I kind of bonded over that, and we talked about, you know, the different shows, and H.R. Puff and stuff was the one that I was really into, and Sigmund and Sea Monster. And he gave me Sigmund and Sea Monster, and we shot that at Coney Island on a 8mm handheld film camera. And yeah, so that was just kind of a thing that happened just because of the popularity of Tripping Daisy, and it came our way. You know, in that process, I got to meet, since he was doing this, you know, Saturday morning cartoon and doing some Sid and Marty Krofft shows in his compilation. He hooked up with Sid and Marty Krofft. So I got to meet those guys.
Wow.
Met with them for an afternoon. They brought out the actual HR Puffin stuff, the guy that played HR Puffin stuff in his suit to be in the Saturday morning cartoon thing. I got to meet him. Crazy. And then one of the Banana Splits, I can't remember his name, but one of the Banana Splits guys was there. So that was cool. That was like a dream come true because I was such a Sid and Marty Krofft fan as a kid. And so, yeah, I had little things like that happened, you know, just like the Scrubs deal happened with the Spree.
Right.
There's things that happen just because you're, you know, you're doing things and people want to, you know, have you be a part of it. That's kind of
I think people listening to this, you know, this is Wild West filmmaking, and it's one of those things of like, this is just how, you know, I talk about how I did it. You know, there's no, I think a lot of people think that there's a step, and there is sort of a process. I mean, there is a process that you try and do, but in this day and age with social media and with streaming and with Hollywood kind of imploding in a way, and, you know, Spotify and music, it is kind of the wild, wild west, but there still is, you know, a way to do it. But for you guys, you know, you were kind of on that first realm of like, you know, there were CDs, there was, you know, DVDs, VHS. When you did the Sid and Marty Krofft, was that a chance, was a door opened of like, or for people to start contacting you, or did your wheel start turning that you wanted to start composing? Because I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, the first thing that you composed is Visioneers, the Zach Galifianakis.
That was actually the second thing. The first thing was Thumbsucker.
Oh, you did Thumbsucker first?
Yeah.
Wow. And if people haven't seen Visioneers, that movie is a trip. It was so ahead of its time, like so far ahead of its time. It's hilarious. The music is phenomenal. And it just kind of like, it was that weird dark period, I think, of like the early 2000s, the early aughts being swallowed by this new Hollywood. And I think if that movie was made like in 2002 or like maybe 1998, it would have been like mind blowing. But it just dropped off the radar. Maybe Zach Galifianakis wasn't Zach Galifianakis yet.
What?
Okay, so you did. So, okay, let's talk about composing Thumbsucker, which is like, goodness gracious, just I see that poster, I get chills because I think of y'all's, of your music and the composing, and it's such a nostalgic soundtrack and film. And I know during that time, just being in the orbit of you, and you guys were on a major tour, I guess this goes back to our being able to handle chaos and like being able to man in the sea it during the chaos. You composed the Thumbsucker soundtrack. How'd that come about? Mike Mills is one of my favorite. I mean, he's like a, gosh, he's so great. Everything he does, I love. And how did that come about? And how was it composing that on a tour bus?
So we had played a show at the Wiltern Theater. It was a New Year's Eve, I think, show. We played, and Granddaddy was, it was us and Granddaddy, New Year's Eve in Los Angeles at the Wiltern. I think that's the Wiltern Theater. Mike Mills was at that show, and he contacted some people at Hollywood. It got back to me that he wanted to meet with me about just come have a conversation. So we met at this coffee shop, and at the time he was making Thumbsucker, and it was time to do the, you know, have the music. In the middle of it, Elliot Smith was doing the music, and you know, unfortunately, and you know, Elliot Smith passed during the making of that film. At the time, Mike was, you know, in a real funk. It halted the film. it halted everything about it. He was going through his own thing at the same time, dealing with the loss of Elliot, and he was not in a good space. When his friend said, "You need to come see the Polyphonic Spree and get out of this funk." And so he came to the show and told me, he goes, "Man, I've been living in this kind of dark place for a while, and your show just knocked me out, and like, I'm on board, blah, blah, blah. I love what's going on. Would you have any interest in, you know, helping score in this film?" And told me the circumstances with Elliot. And I said, "Yeah, I haven't done it. I'll just do what I do. And, you know, either you like it or you don't, no hard feelings." And he goes, "All right, let's just go for it." And we had a really great conversation. It was very open. He didn't tell me anything. He told me no tone. He told me nothing. I just said, "What I'd like to do is if I could just watch the film and then, you know, put my kind of the tone, how I feel musically to it. And I'll just kind of improvise this world, you know, emotionally, musically, what I think." And so he sent me a couple scenes and I did it. And he loved it and had no feedback. And he goes, "I love it." He goes, "This is great. Just keep going." So then he sent me another one and I did another one. He goes, "All right, let's do this." And so it just was like that. I mean, it was like he was so open. He never gave me any direction except for one time, like of a scene that he needed music for that he didn't know he's going to need music for. And this was we were on the road and he needed it like in 24 hours. It was something crazy. And we pulled over at a church and did it. And it was for the scene where Justin's riding a bike and Keanu Reeves, or they hook up, and he wanted this kind of punk rock, kind of rock song that was high energy, and which was completely not what we were at the time. But he didn't want to put canned music in it. He didn't have to buy anything. So we just made this music. And we pulled over this church and asked if we could come in and record this thing. And we did it on tour and knocked it out and sent it to him. Other than that, you know, it was such a great experience for me. I'm like, this is what it's like to score a film. I didn't have to deal with the music supervisor. It was just straight me and the director and him telling me, you know, "I need this and this and, you know, I love it. I love it. This is great." And, you know, I'm like, I'm just doing what I want to do. And I'm like, "Fuck, this is amazing." And so we did that. It was great. I loved it. The experience I was like, "Geez, sign me up." And I had an agent at the time in the midst of that, Maria Machado. And so she was handling me. I said, "Send me some more stuff." I go, "This is great." You know, and then I had another, I think my second one was Visioneers. And it was a little bit more difficult, you know.
It's dark.
The start of that, he kind of had a, it took us a while to kind of find the tone of it. It was weird. I told him, I go, I said, that film reminded me of the Planet of the Apes. I don't know why. That's the feeling I had musically about that.
Yeah.
The way that the music was used in the, I'm talking early Planet of the Apes film. And I told that to him. I go, "This is how I'm kind of seeing. I don't know. And he's like, "Well, that's weird. I mean, that's, I don't know, but that's where I'm kind of going from." And it took us a while to kind of find, he was more hands-on and very like, "I want it to be like this," and kind of like trying to guide me in certain things. And you know, the main title theme is something that I came up emotionally with it that I liked a lot, and we ended up using that as the main part that you see, like when they get together at the end, and it's kind of revisited throughout. But the rest of the stuff is kind of hands-on, and it wasn't as fluid and as like as it was with Mike. Then I had another experience that was just a complete nightmare, where I'm dealing with a music supervisor And he and I just were not getting along. And it was just a total nightmare. And micromanaging everything I'm doing, I felt like I couldn't breathe. I couldn't do anything. And I'm having to jump through these little hoops. And just, it was a nightmare. And that's when I kind of got sour to go, this is just not like, I had a really, really great experience my first film. And then from that point forward, it just kind of started to get really lackluster. And I thought, if this is how it's going to be, they're going to be telling me how they want it. And, you know, and I'm having to like do someone else's thing. It's just not, it doesn't work for me. It's like, if you like what I do, great. This is what I do. If it works for you, then we're going to rock. And I'm not really the one. I want this and I need it to be like this. And if it resonates with me, then I'll do it. But for the most part, I kind of got what I do. And that just is what it is. So things come along great that fit in that world, I'll try it. But I haven't really kind of put myself out there since then that much.
So yeah, because I feel like the perfect world for you would be, you know, living a life where the Mike Mills style, which is like, yeah, here's my film. And do you think, like, that was even one of my questions I think I had written down, was working with, let's see here. Yeah, we'll just say this one. It's, has there ever been a time that you were writing or recording music? Well, this is different, but we'll go with it. And realize that later it was unconsciously inspired by a film that you'd seen. And this is just for Polyphonic Spree, for Tripping Daisy. Like, has there ever been a moment? Because I think about that with, like, how you compose and how you write, you know, when you're doing your own music, have you ever been watching a movie and that movie sparked something where you're like, oh my gosh.
Yes. So it sparked The Old Man and the Sea, believe it or not. It sparked the song, On the Ocean, Let Them Be, Let Them Be. What's that song? Is that on? Is that on Yes, It's True? From the Water. I think it's called Let Them Be. It's on Yes, It's True, Spree. That, when I was writing that song, I literally had, and it doesn't sound like anything from the film. It's just, you know, you can watch a film and you get so into it sometimes that you kind of start coming up with your own narrative when you're lost in the scene or you're lost in watching the picture that, I do this sometimes where I'm so into it that I kind of like, maybe I'm supposed to be here, but as I'm in the scene, I kind of move over here and I'm kind of creating my own scene that's going on within that same scene. I do that and I did that. I had that going on the TV while I'm sitting there trying to write a song because I needed another song for that record. And I came up with this whole scenario of these people that were on this beach but it all came from that movie. That's the only one I can kind of say that specifically happened to, but subconsciously it may have happened, you know, in other areas, but that's one that just comes to mind.
But maybe a lot of people don't know that before a Polyphonic Spree show, I think you still do it, you guys walk out to Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah.
Which song is that?
It's The Strong.
Strong.
Yeah.
And that's just because Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I mean, that's one of the films that like changed my world of like, I knew I wanted to do that. I didn't know. I thought maybe I kind of wanted it to be the ugly. Like I like character acting.
Yeah.
That's my favorite. And I was always just too young to be Sling Blade or to be the ugly or to be, you know, and so it was like, well, I guess you gotta be cool and be like Clint Eastwood. I didn't know that I wanted to be Sergio Leone, you know.
Right.
I didn't know that, you know, and that's what's wild is like full circle. I'm 48 years old and it's the first time I've felt not content, like I've done it, but more like, okay, this is what I put the shoes on and it's like, oh my gosh, these shoes fit perfectly. Where have these shoes been my whole life?
Right.
I've been trying to, you know, all my friends were in bands, so it was like I would try to play the guitar, and I'm just like, "What am I doing?" Or if I try to sing, I sound like whoever I just listened to on the radio. Like I never had my own thing in life until acting. It was, you know, going on auditions and being told no. It wasn't really that. It was more, I felt like once I got things cooking on set, they were like, okay, Josh, you know, your 2 days are over. We'll see you later. And in 2-3 years, the movie comes out, or maybe not at all, or they cut me out of the Claritin commercial, or, you know, whatever the thing was. And I was like, maybe I don't want to do movies. I just didn't know that I wanted to create the entire thing, which is, gosh, there's days I wish I was an actor where I was just on set for 1 or 2 days, because, you know, you live with it forever. I mean, the same with you for, you know, being a musician is every song you've ever written is still swirling around, and then you perform it. You just got off tour. Do you think that, like, in a perfect world, you would like to just do stuff like Mike Mills, compose? I'm not saying just for Mike Mills, but like just do that, like compose films. Would that be something that you'd be like, okay, the shoes fit?
You know, Josh, I love movies and films so much, and I love the way music and film work. I love the emotion that film adds. I mean, that music adds to film. I love all of that. And I always like, I want to make my own movie, but I haven't made a movie. And I have these ideas that I want to do this, I want to do that. And I haven't found what it is. And there is a yearning there, and I can't quite figure it out. Yeah, I want to make music for it, but at the same time, I want to be more of it, more in it in a different way. I don't know. That's the one thing I haven't quite figured out for myself yet. And I don't know if it's acting, you know, I've done some things with you. I'm not an actor. You know, I say I'm not an actor, but I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I look at you like you're an actor, and I'm doing the best I can, and I like that, you know? And it's like, I can't find what it is. I want to be a part of it, but I'm not where I want to be with it yet, where I'm supposed to feel myself within film and music. And I don't know what it is yet. You know, I'll get there. I'll figure it out. I've got such a love for it. It's going to have to reveal itself and find, you know, I've got something that's coming up. There's some people that want me to do this musical. And I'm going to read for it in the spring and try to see if I'm going to do it or not. But I've never done anything like that. I'm going to see, maybe that'll be something that I want to do. I don't know. But
I mean, do you, and I think I know the answer to this, but do you like to do things that make you nervous? I mean, obviously we don't like to do, I mean, for an example, I remember y'all came to an Ochre House play, and then I think something got offered, and then you were like, y'all went and did Rocky Horror Picture. Y'all performed that, but you like perform. You didn't just you dressed up.
Yeah,
performed, and I know that made you nervous.
Yeah,
but was it something like a thrill? Something? Do you like to do things that make you nervous like that? Because it's like you don't want to do it forever, but it'll open up a door, or it's like cold plunging almost in a way. Oh,
yeah. Yes, I do. I find that I do like that feeling. I do like overcoming that in the moment, which is great when it happens. I was, you know, real nervous to do that. But yeah, once I got in it, I kind of embraced it, and it was pretty great. It was a lot of fun. I think you're always trying to like push yourself to see, you know, out of your comfort zone, to see where you're going to find yourself in a weird way. And so hopefully it'll come along that way too. I have a real passion for it. I always have. And I'm not in where I want to be with it yet. I don't know what that it is, but hopefully it'll reveal itself. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way you've gone about it, I think, and the way that the Polyphonic makes people feel like the Mike Mills moments, it's weird. It's like, I think people think that you have it figured out, that everyone has it figured out. You know, you hear these stories of Josh Brolin, and it's just like, I mean, his life was just falling apart. And then he gets to read for No Country for Old Men. You know that story of like how he sent the tape in? So he was doing a Quentin Tarantino
movie,
and Quentin shot his reel. And then the Coen brothers were like, I don't think he's right for the part, but who shot this reel?
Exactly.
And he says, this is a really funny story. I think about you all the time when I hear, it's on Josh Brolin's book. It's in his new book. And he says that when he was filming No Country for Old Men, you know, a lot of people think that people improvise with the Coen brothers. Right. And it's not, there's no improv. And it's very, very seldom. And he said when he's out in the field and he's, you know, watching that guy, and the guy hasn't moved by the tree, and he goes up there and he opens up the briefcase.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, there's no lines. Like it was, and he told Ethan, he was like, I feel like the character would say something. And he goes, I don't think like he'd say something, because maybe like a noise or something. And Ethan goes, what kind of noise were you thinking? And he goes, well, let me try. He goes, just try a couple of them. And he goes, he opens it up and he goes, hmm. And then Ethan goes, okay, let's try a couple more. And he does the, and he does it like a hmm. And on that third hmm, Ethan started laughing. He's like, that's enough. That's enough. And he's like, I just felt really exposed and weird. And he goes, every screening of No Country for Old Men, I know where Ethan Coen's sitting in the theater, because whenever I open up that briefcase and I go, hmm, he dies laughing. And he goes, I don't know what that means.
Right, but it worked.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is, like, you know, people ask, you know, why do we do this? It's almost like it just comes out of you, and it's the best and most positive way is to create something. But for me, it's like, it's obviously, it's the end product. I love it. I love the fact that, you know, I can have some posters on the wall and, you know, and you can go to red carpets and screenings. But really, it's those moments for me of like, it's the thing that nobody in the room knows.
Right.
But the,
Right. You know? Right.
And that's why, if someone was to sum up, like, why do I love, you know, taking all these moments out of my life and, you know, for 2 years, I mean, I started filming 2 years ago today, El Tonto Per Cristo. And not one day has gone by where it hasn't been 90% about this movie, getting it ready and getting it done. And it's not for the faint of heart, obviously. It's not for, but it's for the moments. I swear, it really is, because we would have those on set and there'd be little moments where I'll send you a picture of like you and Kenny. And it's just like, it's another world that we all get to. We're all adults, but we get to leave all of our responsibilities, all of our, and we put on more responsibilities and more like stress, but we all get to like pretend, and it feels like the world's all right. You know, it's the old man in the sea moment. It feels like.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's great when it's all working. And that, in this film in particular, you really feel it. But there's, you know, and I told you that from the very beginning, right when I got on set, I knew that this is a special film. Like, this is like, there's something to this that you just feel just by being on set, you know, it's there. And then when you see it, you're like, wow. But it's like, I felt it on the set, but without seeing anything, just being on there and then watching different scenes being made and filmed, and then the general vibe of that, of being in the orbit of the film, you could just tell, like, there's something going on here. And of course, when you watch it, you're like, oh God, yeah, there's something majorly going on here. And I watched it that night at the Texas Theater. It was like, I felt so proud to be a part of that film. I was just like, wow, man. It just felt bigger than life. It was so beautiful. It was like a being in a, I don't know. It gave me the old man in the sea vibe. It's the tempo of it's so so comforting, and it's like easy listening for me. It's very, I don't know, it just feels good to me in being that space.
Yeah,
and I felt on set. So yeah, when you're able to do those things and have those moments like you're talking about, and then have it also be where it's part of your set in the scene, and it's like it's in the air, then that's, I don't know. I mean, that seems to be the recipe you need to have make a really good film. You have to be able to have those moments you're talking about, and be able to have, you know, the interaction with the actors and the people on set, the crew and everybody, somewhat gives that leveled playing field of everyone being on the same page. And it's almost like a big body that's all breathing and laughing at the same time, and we're all like in it together. I don't know. Just, you could feel that on that set.
Yeah, it's weird. It was, you know, one of the projects, probably one of the very few or only projects that I've ever worked on or created where I felt like I was just hovering above it. It wasn't like, I never felt like, look what I'm doing. It almost felt like I was trying to keep up with it. I didn't want it to fall apart, because it was just this, like you said, it was this its own breathing organism.
Yeah.
And it's so weird because, you know, when you make something like an album and you're just listening, I mean, my gosh, you're listening to it. When you're making a movie, it's, you got to do the movie, then you got to do the edits, and then you got to do the sound design, and then you got to do the score. And you just watch the movie so many times and those scenes so many times that this is so bizarre that I don't, every time I watch this movie today, like if I screen it for somebody, or, you know, it's not even out in the world yet. It comes out October 6th. And I feel like I could just keep watching it.
Yeah. And
it's so bizarre because most of the things I do, not that they're cringy or cringeworthy to sit through. It's just kind of like, well, that was cool. That was a moment. And I'm really proud of it, but I can't really live in it. But I feel like this film is something that, like, I can live with. I can, like, I'm really proud of it. And it feels like, and that's when you know it's not you. It's like, gosh, it was just, everything was hitting. Everything was, and you can't recreate that. And I think that's what people try to do, like, with the studios and with the person that you were talking about, which was like, they're trying to make you do magic, right? They're trying to, and it's like, well, I don't know. That's not how it works.
Right. I mean, did you feel like you kind of became, you've done stuff before, This World Won't Break prior. Did you feel like you've kind of became a director on that film? Like, really became, I don't know. It's just, not that you weren't before, and this break is great. I'm just saying, on that film, you said that you were like, you're trying to, like, you're, you know, crazy, just trying to, I didn't see that at all. I saw someone who was basically the orb that's kind of going in and out of everything. It's kind of in control of his vision, knows what he wants. And yeah, there's some things going on, but you've got a glow around you, and you're handling it. You're doing it. We're going across the fucking ocean to get to this island. You've made stuff happen. And it's like, and you're the boss, and everyone's looking to you, and you're holding it well. And I just saw, I was like, this is, he's matured. He's in his shoes. He's doing it. He's directing. This is happening. This is real. And I don't know. But that was just of you. But overall, I thought the overall orbit of that film was just, I don't know. It glowed. Something about it.
Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, I do feel like today I'm different than when I first started. You know, there was a lot of, not that you ever stop self-doubting or have the imposter syndrome. I think that's just nature. And I think there's moments, those things pop up when you are around something that's greater than you, and you are going to feel imposter syndrome. But I do feel like that felt like, okay, I can really call myself a filmmaker, because, you know, one time you can get lucky, right? You can write and direct something and get lucky. And this one, I felt like, you know, you're always like, well, is this going to be as good as my first thing? And I feel like this one was better than my first thing. Cause a lot of times they say a filmmaker's first film is their best film. And I'm like, oh man, I guess the first film, you know, I'm really proud of it. But this film, I felt like I can do a, I always thought that I could never do something big, like a Disney project or something that was big. And now I realize, oh, yeah, I could. You know, it's just different people. It's just more people at craft services.
Yeah.
They're all doing the same exact thing. There's just 20 instead of one.
Right.
And you're not having to deal with the 20 anymore because they've hired somebody to deal with all them. So you're really even more focused on
the
project at hand. So, you know, because the first movie, I didn't have any help. It was just me, sound, camera. That is it. And on this, it was like, I think I had at least 10 people every day. And that felt like 100.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm still hands-on. I think that's what I love about doing filmmaking is, you know, I had a production designer in Kristen Harden, but I was still like, I still had to hang the picture on the wall. And I don't ever want to lose that. I don't ever want to lose the...
I don't think you'll lose that.
No. I mean, I love, like, you know, going out and picking out everyone's costumes and location scouting. I mean, I spent 6 months location scouting and, like, taking pictures of the time of day it was. So when everybody was ready to shoot, the sun was where it has been every day for 6 months. And I think that that's something that, you know, and you're the same way, like, my gosh, this with the polyphonic spree and like, you're going to get it done. Like you just had to do it with Tripping Daisy again. Like when it's all said and done, you got to break everything down. You got to sell the merch, you know? Yeah. And I think that's what keeps people that are creative. It keeps their artistic twinkle in the eye. I think it keeps things going because there's people who don't even know how to do that. They've never done it because they signed with a label or, you know, there's some Nepo thing and they just walked onto set. But man, I've been in so many, it's what we talked about with the chaos. I think that when you're in chaos and things are falling apart on a music video or a short film or whatever you're doing or a commercial shoot, that if you do it for 20 years, you can feel confident that when you're making a movie, if something goes wrong, you're like, well, let's just
pivot. You know,
let's just spin. It was like, you know, there's a scene in the film where we, it was written in the script that a albino armadillo walks down the hall, in the monastery, and Father John, it sounds like this huge creature coming down the hall. And then when he looks at the door, it's this albino armadillo, like this tiny little creature. And then it walks off real softly. And it's like, but the people weren't calling me back. And I was like freaking out. It was the day before. And then they finally answered the phone. They're like, Herman, the albino armadillo passed away, Josh. And so, I was like, oh my gosh. Cause it's like, you know, it's ingrained in your head and you're just like, there can't be anything else. And they go, we have an albino snake. And I was like, well, that's too on the nose. It's too, that's the devil.
That would have been perfect. So did you go spray paint one?
No. So I'm standing out there and talking to people on the phone. And there's this guy on a little farm. Cause we were out in Towakana and he had all these goats. And I was like, maybe I can use one of his goats. And I go over there and he was deaf and mute. And so he couldn't understand what I was saying. So the guy that was on set every day knew sign language and talked to him. And then he goes, he has one more goat and it's kind of scary looking. And that's the goat we used in the movie. And we had to board up, because we're on the third floor of that building. We had to board up all the windows. Because he said that goat will be spooked and he'll just jump out of a window. But we're on the third floor. So we put mattresses on all the windows.
My gosh.
And then he was freaked out by my cowboy hat. So I hid behind the camera. And when he walked down the hall, I popped my head up. And that's when he like goes, and he like backs up. And we got it.
Got
it. He kind of has like a demonic with this, with this thing. And so it's one of those things of like, then it becomes like, once you get that moment of like uncomfortable, freak out, what are we going to do? And then the goat, now you can reimagine.
Totally.
Now it's becoming something else. And when we were filming the scene, when Matthew Posey opens up the thing and sees all the stuff in the kitchen, for people who haven't seen it out there, it wasn't working. It was supposed to be like this Tarkovsky scene, and it was becoming kind of comical, and we were just, I mean, I was having issues. And so we re-blocked it, and I remember Frank Mosley coming over right before we started shooting. He goes, "Hey, me and Matt, we got it." He goes, "You've got your shot." He goes, "Just know, like, this part of the film is more like Jim Jarmusch than like Bresson. So don't think that you're," he goes, "think the film's taken its own course."
Yeah.
And that really, like, let me go, oh, he goes, "This isn't even a Jim Jarmusch film." He goes, "It's a Josh Jordan film."
Right.
"So just know, like, we're going to figure it out."
Right.
You know, it doesn't have to be this thing. And I feel like that's just kind of, that's just kind of how it is, like creating, you know? And I feel like, I think it was in one of your documentaries with the Polyphonic Spree, it was the piano player for David Bowie. I think you wanted to like give up on a song. You're like, "Maybe we don't put it on." Right. You're like, "Maybe we don't put it on the album." Right. And he was like, "No, it's like this." And he like pushed you.
Pushed me, him and John both.
And it was like, I mean, can you imagine not having that song?
Yeah, it's that's a Younger Yesterday.
Yeah, and that song gives me chills.
When I know, that. I can't imagine. But yeah, pushing, yeah, exactly. Yeah, because you get an idea of something in your head, and all of a sudden, for whatever reason, it's not working. And all of a sudden, you know, someone does something, hits something different, and all of a sudden you're thinking, you're freed from what you were attached to before, and you're wide open to be able to look at it another way. And I ended up improvising a lyric, a really belted, passionate lyric that's one of my favorites on that whole record. It happened in that song. And this was a song I didn't even want to do. So it's like, it's weird how you can pivot like that, you know?
But that's what makes it exciting. And that's the thing that's like you were talking about with that, you know, people forcing you into this little box where you're like, "Well, that's not my strong." You're putting a, you know, a gorilla in this tiny cage and asking it to do stuff, but it needs to swing on the trees.
Yeah, man.
You know? Totally. And that's how I feel. I think that, you know, the scary part for me is like, I've only made films with nobody telling me what to do. And right. Maybe that's good because I'm like fine tuning and I can probably be able to, you know, work that out. Okay, before we wrap up, you want to let everybody know what's going on with Tim DeLauder?
No, I mean, what's up?
That's what people do in podcasts.
When's this coming out?
Yeah, so this movie will have its world premiere October 6th at the Texas Theater.
No, this podcast.
Oh, this podcast. I was using my announcer voice too. This podcast will be out Tuesday.
Tuesday. So yeah, so what I have coming up is I've got a show at the Granada where we're playing Together We're Heavy in its entirety from start to finish, which we've never done as a band. So that'll be neat. And then got a show in Tulips in Fort Worth at Tulips doing the same thing. Another night with the Polyphonic Spree doing Together We're Heavy. And then we have the Christmas show coming up in December that we've been doing every year. And in February, the Spree might be going to the UK for a few shows. And Tripping Daisy is probably going to go on tour again for Midwest and West Coast.
And you have Resolution in theaters.
And Resolution. Thanks for bringing that up. That's playing right now in Montreal at the... set it's going to be playing in the Dolly Museum in Florida, and it just won the Portland Film Festival, and yeah, it's doing its thing, making the rounds in dome theaters and planetariums.
It's all growed up.
It's growed up. It's doing its thing.
It left for college and
left. It's gone.
Sometimes it calls you on the weekends.
Yeah, exactly.
And you got one in college right now.
Yeah, Felix is there right now.
Gosh.
He's in Arkansas doing his thing.
Mind-blowing to me.
I know, man. He was little Felix, and now he's off to college. And yeah.
I know. He's quite the gentleman. When I saw him last at the record store, I was like, "Fee, man, you turned in quite the gentleman."
Yeah, he's not the little kid anymore. He's just this guy, and reserved, and he's a sweet boy.
I know. We're empty nesters. Look at us. Yep. Oh, let's go make a movie, or I think the last movie we watched together was Lawrence of Arabia. Was it?
Was it?
I think.
Wow, that's a good one to hold off on. I mean, I went and saw freaking Jaws the other night, 50th anniversary at AMC and IMAX, and I was thinking of you, but did you see it?
I didn't. Literally every single day, like I'm leaving here to go pick up merchandise. This film, we're doing it crazy style. It's Wild West filmmaking, and we're taking it on the road like we're the Polyphonic Spree. We're selling merchandise and showing the thing, doing Q&As. And as of right now, we have, I think, almost 15 shows that we're going to be doing across the U.S. And then I'm leaving after our Texas tour in October. At the end of October, we go to Greece, and then we go to Romania. And
God, you're going to Greece.
Yeah.
That's my bucket list. I've always wanted to go there since high school.
So Greece and then Romania, and they are flying out the composer Michael Periscavis, and a Romanian orchestra is going to do the score of the film in downtown Iași, Romania.
Oh, my God. That's awesome, Josh.
Some pretty wild... that's the whole prophet's not holding whatever in his own town. So it's like people in Romania are freaking out on the movie.
And, oh, that's great.
Yeah. So I think it'll be a big success in Greece. And then when we come back, people want to see it here in the United States of America.
Like, once people see this thing, it's like the timing is perfect. People need this film more than ever right now. Mm-hmm. I think the timing is so poignant with how the world is in general.
For sure. Maybe this will be somebody else's Old Man in the Sea.
Yeah, maybe it will. It's mine too. It's my backup. And I happen to be in it. That's not too distracting.
That's great. I'm normally in all my stuff, and I'm in this one for all you see is my silhouette. But I cut out the scene I was in. But sometimes you got to kill your darlings in this business. It's not about me.
It's not. It's about the picture. It's you. You're all over that film. You are. It's just amazing. It's you, Josh.
Thanks, man. Well, thanks for always being a part of my stuff and then opening up doors for me. It's always been a big help for me and a big it means a lot.
We're in it together. We've kind of grown up in this stuff, and I'll keep doing it as long as you have me.
I'll keep doing it as long as you keep doing it then. All right, y'all take it easy.